Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. I once described the science topic on today's show as being very Alice in Wonderland. The idea that mushrooms might be grown as insulation for buildings, roads, and pipes in cold northern climates just seems magical to me. But it's not magic. Research shows it is possible. Still, mushroom insulation is not yet for sale at Lowe's or Home Depot. It is an ongoing research project by an assistant professor at UAA's School of Public Health. For several years now, this scientist has been growing the mycelium, or underground network that supports above-ground mushrooms, into lightweight shapes and substances and a substance that shows strong insulating properties. He's had challenges and successes and keeps finding financial support to continue the work. So please welcome our guest today, Dr. Filip Amstaslavski. He'll share this local science story with us and describe what's ahead in his work. Welcome, Filip. Say hello.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, everyone. Thank you very much.
So happy to have you here. And just before we dive in, I just want to let our guests know, or our listeners know, that they might have questions about this as we talk about it. And it's fine for them to call up and ask a question. They might wonder, once this sort of mushroom insulation is installed, does it keep growing, for example? Or are there toxins to worry about? Or does it naturally biodegrade? So we want to welcome your questions, and they're always welcome on Hometown Alaska. You can call us at 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752 statewide. And we can also take your emails at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So hopefully we'll get some questions and we'll spark the curiosity of some of the listeners. So, Filip, let's just talk about you. Tell me who you are. Your interesting last name. So you're originally from Russia, right?
Correct.
And you grew up in Siberia?
Yes, in Western Siberia.
Right. The son of scientists, right?
That's correct.
So that's a long journey from there to here. How did you get to Alaska?
Sure. I grew up first in the Urals, in the Ural Mountains. That's the natural geographic divide between Asia and Europe. We then moved to Yamal Peninsula for my parents' work.
And were they both biologists, or?
Yes, they were both wildlife biologists.
Okay.
My father's area was on salmon, and
sounds familiar to Alaskans, right?
Yes, and my mom studied lemmings, and so that brought them to Yamal Peninsula, which is above the Arctic Circle. It's a it's a tundra region that's not different in the landscape in some ways to Barrow. And then when I was six, we moved to Moscow.
Okay.
After the fall of Soviet Union, when the Iron Curtain collapsed, we moved to Israel. My entire family moved to Israel. And then we, after service in the Israeli army and after some trouble, I came to U.S. To study.
So, and you arrived in Alaska not so long ago. So you studied, I guess, on the East Coast, a couple of places, but eventually sought a job here. Why did you choose Alaska? Was it kind of the memory of the North that you were trying to get back to?
Yes, that for sure. We were looking for a good place to raise our family, and I was very interested in northern issues and research in the north, so it was a perfect storm of events, and there was a position here, and that prompted me to come.
So I think you've been here, what, since 2014, something like that?
Yes, fall of 2013.
Okay, and you're affiliated both with UAA and UAF, I believe, right?
I'm associate professor of public health at the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Okay, and let's link up your public health interest with your research project. So,
sure.
Tell us how they are linked. In other words, we're talking about growing insulation from natural materials, and you're a public health expert. So, how do those two things come together?
Yes, that's a great question. And my thinking about this developed over the years. We recently began to recognize that our health and well-being is influenced and often prescribed by the social and physical and biological environment around us. And that mindset really requires you to collaborate and look across disciplines, across the domains of science and engineering, to come up with some answers to questions about how those relationships shape and how can we change some of the relationships that we have established between the way we, for example, build our houses and indoor air quality and outdoor air quality and respiratory health and other issues that come to bear on this relationship across the species, across the domains, across the ecologies. So that's where this interest really came from. And I think in Alaska, the overriding need we all know about is the need to keep warm, especially
yes.
in this recent cold spell.
Yeah.
We all recognize that, you know, keeping our houses and our infrastructure intact depends on how well they're insulated.
Correct.
So that prompted the question, well, how do we do it now? And the way we do it is by using petroleum-based products. And they do the job. They do the job well. They keep our pipes from freezing. They keep our houses warm. But there are costs to this. And the costs are twofold. One is that the impact of petroleum-based products on the CO2 emissions is great. And producing something like blue foam or pink foam for insulation is very costly.
That's what we typically use now, right?
Yes.
Blue foam or pink foam.
That's what you would find in most modern construction and in many cases underlayment as the, for the roads and pipe insulation.
Yeah, I didn't realize that we had foam under the roads to keep them from, I guess, buckling and frost heaving.
Yes.
Yes. I knew there was something there. I thought it was gravel. You know, I just didn't know. So it's amazing to me to think that there's actually insulation under the roads as well. So.
Yes. No, it's necessary. And the same goes true for our pipeline. The Alaska pipeline north of Brooks Range has a wide swath of petroleum-based foam that looks kind of like blue foam,
mm-hmm.
That prevents it prevents the ground from heaving under the posts,
mm-hmm.
To keep the pipeline intact. So that's the first cost, and the second cost is the cost on air quality. As we make our houses tighter, air has less openings to come and the vapor barrier doesn't travel
ventilation,
as freely.
Ventilation, yeah.
Across, exactly, from the inside out to outside. So that has impact on air quality because essentially many of those foamed products, they are kind of like tiny airbags that enclosed in many, many, many other tiny airbags, plastic bags,
mm-hmm.
if you will, if you look at it microscopically. So there isn't much movement of air between outside and inside, and that contributes to air quality issues that are within our houses. And so, these are the two areas where we decided to innovate, and we compiled a team that consists of Dr. Joy Young, professor of civil engineering here at the University of Alaska, who is a specialist on cold climate construction. Permafrost construction, myself, and we have been working with a biochemistry student, Maria White, also a student at the University of Alaska, undergraduate student, and Dan Mahoney, who is a last year engineering student here at UAF.
So students are getting some shots at the research. That's great.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So bring us to what the work actually is. You're trying to grow insulation, but what does that look like? How do you do it?
Sure. So to describe it in very simple terms, we use a culture of a common fungus that's found in Alaska. We add that living culture, living cells of that organism to a blend that we have created.
Sort of like a smoothie?
kind of like it. It looks more like oatmeal.
Okay.
In consistency. The major component of that blend is basically broken down sawdust.
Okay, wood fiber.
Yes, wood fiber and cellulose and lignin that's chopped up.
Tasty wood fiber.
Tasty for the fungus.
For the
exactly.
fungus, yeah.
And we allow the fungus to grow through it.
So it's sending all these little network, almost like roots, but they're not roots really, right?
Yes, yes. And these roots, we call them mycelia. They are the tiny rootlets that create the network, underground network, that allows the fungus to derive its nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
So those rootlets, they feed on the blend that we give to the fungus. As soon as that process begins, we see that this oatmeal solidifies and becomes kind of like a block. And within a week, we get essentially panels that look not unlike your styrofoam blocks that are bound. So that all those pieces of fiber that we've given to fungus to eat it are now bound into the matrix.
It's
a composite.
It grows through it.
Yes.
It eats it and it consumes it, right?
Yes, it feeds on it. So
feeds
essentially,
on it.
It takes the nutrients from the blend that we give it, and it breaks them down, but it also grows very rapidly. As it grows, it creates this tiny air pockets. And the mycelium itself is it's massive tublets that are hollow inside that are comprised of mycelium that essentially trap air. And
which
that's what you want.
This is what insulation is about, right?
Exactly.
Trapping air.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Air is good. Then we have to stop the growth. So we heat the panels so that the water evaporates and the fungus essentially dies. But the chitin, the tublets themselves, remain. And they continue to do their job at trapping air.
They basically make a structure. And even though they're dead, they maintain their structure.
Yes.
So then you have something that could be the shape of a brick or the shape of a sheet of almost like insulation. I've seen pictures of cylinders. That's what I saw when I looked up your work.
So. Yes. It can be, essentially, it can be of any shape.
Mm-hmm.
As long as the organism has enough nutrients to feed on, it will continue to grow. So the shape is independent of the structure.
Ah, it just grows to fill.
That's right.
Ah, okay.
So you can have any mold that you can fill with this blend
mm-hmm.
that we create, and that mold will essentially, you know, become filled with our material once you achieve the properties that you want. So the specific R value, specific
density,
specific moisture content. You can remove the mold and essentially kill the organism
by cooking it or heating it.
Exactly, by heating it. So at that point you end up with a lightweight insulating material that can be used, and that's our thinking that we would eventually be able to use it for applications like like insulation of walls in the houses, underlayment for roads, packaging where thermal insulation is required. And the advantage to this is of course that you end up with a material that's carbon neutral, because we essentially take waste product from forestry industry that would otherwise contribute to CO2 emissions, to carbon dioxide emissions, because now all this carbon is being released into atmosphere because it's becoming it's essentially sitting out there.
Mm-hmm.
We bind it back into a material that serves the function that we need here, pretty much for any construction or any infrastructure improvement project.
Wow. Let me ask this. If you didn't cook it, like it would continue to get more dense. It would continue to grow in that tight space if you did not stop the growth.
Yes, it does. And in fact, we have some specimens in the lab that we have forgotten to kill. And what happens with them?
This sounds like a sci-fi movie now.
It's very real. and what happens with those pieces is that they become very hard. If you take a walk in the woods here, just outside of the studio, you'll see many conchs.
C-O-N-K-S, conchs?
I think that's the proper spelling. Those are polypore fungi that look like brackets. They often sit on the side of the tree.
Right.
And many of them have multiple rings.
Right.
Those rings are rings of seasons, and you can actually count how long this particular organism has been alive by counting the rings. Now, they're very hard. And they're hard because they're comprised mostly of chitin. And chitin is the same material, essentially, the same material as this skeleton, exoskeleton of king crab.
Okay, which we know is
which
crunchy.
Is pretty tough.
Yeah,
yes.
It's tough.
Yes.
Yeah.
And for that, it's very resilient. So when we let this the material to age, essentially, the organism seals itself and solidifies its network and makes it very dense.
Mm-hmm. It just gets denser and denser?
Yes, until it runs out of food.
Okay.
And so for that, those specimens are actually very hard, and one can stand on them.
I see. When I meant a sci-fi movie, what I was thinking about was that, like, maybe these specimens were growing out of the refrigerator, or pushing open the door. Like, they were just growing. But instead, they stay in their confined space. They just get denser.
Yes. We try to contain them.
Yeah. Well, I just want to remind our listeners, if they've just joined us, and we're talking sci-fi, but we're actually really talking science, and it's an interesting opportunity to have a scientist and a researcher on Hometown Alaska. Philippe Amstislavsky is my guest. He's a public health professor working at UAA and researching a way to have insulation, because we all want to be warm in the north, but a way to have insulation that is more lower cost, lower carbon, uses a material that's right here, that grows here naturally. So if you've got questions about this or curiosity about this or a question I haven't thought to ask Philippe, please give us a call at 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752 statewide, or you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. I do want to let folks know that I've put on the alaskapublic.org website for today's Hometown Alaska show a couple of interesting links. There have been some stories written about your work. Those links are there. There's also a video that was actually done here by Alaska Public Media, a little two-minute video that really does a very good job of explaining what you're doing. So if people want to kind of mull this over and think about it, go to the alaskapublic.org website and Hometown Alaska. I think the headline is, "Can Mushrooms Keep Your House Warm?" So take a look at those. So, okay, Philippe, back to you. Let's see. I wanted to ask you whether your focus on mycelium, which is the network, I mean, the mushrooms are the fruiting body above the ground that we can see, but beneath the ground, there's this amazing network. I was wondering how your focus got on that. Was it growing up, in the colder areas of Russia and foraging, or was it when you actually became a scientist and you were looking at the mycelium? How did you kind of get focused on that?
Sure. Well, fungi are important. Culturally, nutritionally, across the north.
Right.
So in circumpolar communities and many places, mushrooms are a source of food.
Right.
An important source of food. They're rich in protein. They have fiber. They have vitamin D that is important in the north. And for many people that don't eat meat, if you live in the north, that's essentially the only non non-chemically produced source of vitamin D.
Mushrooms would be?
That's correct.
Okay.
That would be available.
And it's the fruiting body that you're talking about. That is
correct.
Okay.
Yes.
You know, Philip, I'm going to interrupt you just very quickly because we did get a call and it's a good question. I'd like to welcome Eric on to Hometown Alaska. Hi, Eric. You had a question about this topic. What is it?
Yeah. So it was mentioned that we could be using some of these mycelium structures within buildings as insulation. I think it's a fantastic idea. But is this mycelium going to be flammable? I mean, would it be, would there be a fire risk?
Mm. Good question.
That's a great question. Thank you, Eric. We have done some testing of looking at flammability. And what we find is that the material chars, it doesn't burn readily, just like the chitin within the, if you take a shell of a crab, that shell will not burn. It will char eventually if you keep it in the fire long enough. So that's promising in terms of flammability. We do have, because we add cellulose, if all of the cellulose is not consumed, then the cellulose itself is, of course, the wood is flammable, as we all know. So right now we are working on testing different methods of producing the same quality insulation, essentially the same type of, the same range of R values, the same range of density, but reducing the amount of wood fiber to see if we can improve the flammability, decrease the flammability even more. It's early on. And we don't have all the answers, but we in the next year or so will hopefully have a better answer for you.
Hmm. Very cool. Thank you.
Thanks,
sure,
Eric.
Thank you.
Good question. I'm glad I hadn't thought of it, and it's a good one, so thank you. Okay, so back to where we were. Where were we?
We were talking about the importance of fungi and why fungi and why, why me and why this work would be relevant.
Yeah.
So I mentioned that it's, for northern communities, mushrooms or the fruiting bodies of many fungi are important culturally and nutritionally. Now, growing up in Russia, Russians are known for their love for mushrooms. And it's very common to find mushrooms as staple food in many Russian communities, even here in Alaska.
Right.
So that's the first exposure is of course foraging with my parents and learning to identify these many different species. In Alaska alone, we have over 600 species.
Oh, no, I did not know that. 600? Wow.
Over that number.
And not all of them are edible? Or there's a spectrum here, probably.
Yes, there is a spectrum. Most of them are not dangerous. There are a few of them that are toxic. And of course, many species are, in fact, edible and have been consumed as food.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, it's there is definitely a precedent of eating mushrooms here in Alaska, and it's common across the circumpolar north. So that's the first kind of exposure. But as I looked at this forest ecosystem from a perspective of trying to understand the relationships, one very quickly finds that fungi are present pretty much in every inch of forest soil, in every tree trunk, on every piece of bark that you find, and they're amazing and they're complex. And they're some of the largest organisms on Earth. In fact, they are considered to be the largest living organism on Earth. There is a fungi colony in Switzerland that's so large that it's much larger in size than blue whale, for example, by weight and by expanse.
And we're talking about the The mycelium network.
Correct.
So, I see.
And there's an even larger colony in Oregon that, and it's honey mushroom fungus, which is very commonly harvested for food. And so, just looking at the sheer biomass of those organisms within our forest ecosystems, one becomes really enamored and interested.
Right, in curious.
Curious in how this all works out in terms of, you know, relationships between living trees and decaying trees and fungi collaborating on essentially breaking down the complex organic compounds that the trees produce and, you know, the trees are, mm-hmm. Into basic blocks of life, mm-hmm. right? In returning them back into its ecosystem.
The perfect recycling system.
Yes, yes. Okay.
They break down these large structures until they can feed and nurture more growth.
Yes, absolutely. And the interesting thing about fungi is that they can't photosynthesize. They're not capable to convert light or sun energy into nutrients directly. They are not able to do this. So they have to rely on plants to do the work for them.
Ah, here we come the relationships.
That's right. And here comes this amazing relationship. So you have plants that photosynthesize, and fungi, which cannot, but they need the nutrients, they need the sugars that the trees produce to survive, to feed on. Fungi offer protection to the forest ecosystem by essentially enveloping the rootlets of the trees, the root systems of the trees, in this protective sacs, and protecting them from attack from outside. In return, the trees share some of the sugar that they produce through the process of photosynthesis back to the fungi. So here's this complex relationship. And now we know that most plants have an existing relationship with many species of fungi. And so this relationship continues for the life of the tree, for example. When the tree dies, the breakdown of the organic matter becomes critical. Mm-hmm. Imagine a forest that doesn't disappear.
Yeah, right. It doesn't break down.
Exactly. It would become silent very quickly. It would be littered by tree trunks that are dead but standing.
Right.
Nothing would break them down. So here's another role of fungi, sort of natural fit for them. So that's where the breakdown to basic blocks of life comes in.
Yeah. You know, when we were getting together to talk about doing the show together, I mentioned this book called The Hidden Life of Trees, and neither Philippe nor I had read it yet. But I did put a link on alaskapublic.org to an interesting essay talking about it. And it's a forester who most of his life was about trees as a commodity, but later in life began to understand the relationships, just like you were talking about now, Philippe, between living plants and fungi. And it was just fascinating. So there's a link to that. And the name of the book is The Hidden Life of Trees by, I think, a German forester. So it's really cool. I can't wait to read it. But we didn't really get to sort of how you got focused on the mycelium, because you're not really focused on the fruiting body. You're focused on that structure. But we probably need to take a little break here before we get back into that. So we'll take a little break. I'm here with Philippe Amstislavski. We're talking about fungus and actually end result of, you know, growing insulation from fungus. So we'll be right back. You're listening to Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and we're sort of having a science program here today. I have Philippe Amstislovsky with me. He is an associate professor in public health at UAA and comes from Russia and a long background with his family of foraging for mushrooms. And now in his career as a scientist and a researcher, he's figuring out how, or trying to figure out how these fungus bodies could perhaps be used to grow insulation. So, Philippe, I was in the first half hour. Well, let me throw out our phone numbers if folks have questions. We had a great question in the first half hour about the flammability of this structure. So if you're in Anchorage, you can give us a call at 550-8433. Statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752. And of course, we'd welcome an email at hometownalaskapublic.org. So, Philippe, back to this body, some of which are bigger than a blue whale, you said, when we're talking about the underground structure of a fungus. But how did you get focused on the underground? I was thinking about this fall when my front yard was just loaded with mushrooms, never thinking about what had to be underneath the soil, for all those mushrooms to pop up like they did. So how did you get your focus off the fruiting bodies and into the mycelium, the underground? And what's good about that?
Yes, well, thank you again for having me on the show.
It's fun to have you. Fun. Yeah.
The field of science that focuses on fungi and study of fungi, mycology, is really defined by somewhat of a mystery, because looking at the fruiting body, what we get in our backyards, and last summer was great summer for mushroom harvesting. Yes,
and I was blown away. Right?
Yes, absolutely, and it was a lot of fun to identify all the species that are popping out everywhere because it was the perfect combination of humidity, temperature, and sunlight for this explosion that we witnessed here in Alaska, and yet looking at the fruiting body at the mushroom itself. That we commonly recognize as boletes or chanterelles or morels that we harvest. This is just a tiny bit of the story, both by weight of the actual organism and by its significance. Because what you see is essentially the end product, the reproductive organ of the organism, which produces spores. Right? And so the spores, they're typically airborne.
Okay.
They fly with the air current, and they land somewhere else, and they produce mycelium. And mycelium is where the whole cycle starts. Right? So most of the organism is never seen, and that's where the mystery comes in, because we often have a hard time even identifying the specific type of or specific species because they present themselves as this tightly interwoven network of rootlets, the mycelium, and it's very hard to tell one from another.
Do you do it with DNA analysis? Okay.
Yes, you could, but in the field, that's not practical. And so often we are faced with the question, what this organism is, right? So back to the question as to why mycelium as kind of the backbone of this research and why can it be used for the production of insulation or packaging that we envision, it's quite simple. It grows very fast in favorable conditions and grows faster than most living organisms on the planet.
Really?
Yes, it requires very little resources to grow, and it's resilient because of its chitinous shell. It's tough. Mm-hmm. It self-skins, meaning that it creates skin on the outside to protect itself from attack from mm-hmm. other species, mm-hmm. and so for that it becomes an interesting paradigm because. If we think about the 20th century being the century of engineering, we can think of the 21st century as century of biology and innovation in bioengineering. Because what the bio-based materials allow you to do is to take organic matter and feed it to this organism to do the job that can be production of organism of material that can serve a specific function, right? And for that, we need to really understand the biology behind the organism itself in order to for us to harness its potential. So that's where this work really began.
Yeah, and so the work is figuring out how fast it grows, what shape it can take, what nutrients it really likes. Is that really kind of the everydayness of what you're working on?
Very much so, yeah. Okay. So the practical tasks are really creating composites that are resilient, strong, that can withstand handling, that can be used in a range of applications. And how do you do this? Well, you need to create a feedstock for the organism. You need to select a species that can withstand this different range of environments and grow fast. And that's where our really every day of our biomaterials lab is.
Yeah. Well, I would like to I've got a caller with a question. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we had a caller with a question. But, you know, what can you most of what we've talked about feeding the mycelium is really organic matter. And so we probably waste a lot of organic matter that could be used as food. So is that part of the cycle, sort of a useful, you know, return of organic matter into the system? I'm thinking about cutting grass or cutting, leaves. I mean, is all that potential food?
Yes. Yes. We in fact, could use many times when we drive, say, on Alcan, you see this clearing on both sides of the road for visibility. So this brush has been chopped to allow for vision as we drive. Now, all this biomass is potentially can be used to produce our material.
Ah, I see. So it's sort of amazing. I feel like you said this is the age of the century of biology, and it sort of feels like everything is potentially useful to keep this alive. Now, can you exhaust it? Can you grow it so fast that it depletes itself? I mean, is there anything? Are there limits to mycelium? What have you learned?
Yes, we don't know some of these answers yet because this is early on. Our research is about 2 years old. We know that other folks in other institutions are working on similar questions, but I don't think anybody has all the answers. And we do know that that there is a way to, of course, to exhaust the organism by creating conditions that are not favorable to its growth, mm-hmm. or by pushing it to its limits. But so far, we found that it's very resilient. It's really tough. The species we work with is very, is used to growing in some of the harshest environments on the planet.
Right.
And
the one you're using,
adapted.
The one you're using right now, I think you've referred to as white dash rot fungus, which is really common right here in Anchorage, right?
Yes. Yes. So it's a group of fungi, in fact. And if you take a walk in the woods, even now, you will see dead trunks of trees. When you remove the bark, you can see that the decay in matter is either in brown color or kind of white off white.
Right.
And so there's brown rot and there is the white rot.
Okay.
And that's a very common designation in forestry also because, of course, you don't want your wood to rot because it degrades the quality of the wood itself. So the white rot is a group of fungi that produce specific enzymes that turn the lignin and cellulose within the tree into this whitish matter.
Oh.
So for that, it's called white rot.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the group we use is commonly referred to as polypores.
Oh, polypores.
Polypores, yes.
Okay, okay. We have a question here. This is a good one because we're talking about how you feed the mycelium. Justin in Anchorage is wondering about plastics. He's heard that some mushrooms can grow from plastics and be eaten. Could plastics be used in this instance as well? Does that resonate with you at all, Philippe?
That's an interesting question. I never heard of mushrooms growing from plastics, but chemically, polymers have structure that's somewhat similar to cellulose. And I'm going off on a limb here.
Yeah.
It's possible, of course, that fungi will survive and break down some of the plastics, provided that they're not toxic to the organism. It's not just the plastic; it's what's added to the plastic itself.
For, right.
You know, for so, Justin has a good question. I don't know of successful way of producing food from plastic using mushrooms.
So maybe, you know, you said your research is only 2 years old. Maybe that's something you'll figure out. But you seem motivated to move away from plastics. You know, the polymers and the petroleum-based products, because of things like insulation and tight houses, they emit some things that are not so good for respiratory health, things like that. So I think he's getting at something interesting, though, that, you know, all this plastic that's in our environment, could fungus break it down for us? I mean, that's not really what you're working on. You're working on growing insulation. But any thoughts on that, that fungus could actually help us get rid of all this plastic?
It's way from my focus.
Yeah.
What I believe is that by providing successful alternatives to plastics, we can reduce the amount of plastic in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's not answering Justin's question
exact
directly.
Question. Yeah.
Yes, but I think that if we have less blue and plastic foam going into our walls, and we replace it with biologically and environmentally sound material that performs on par with plastics, and then at the end of the life of the structure, we can just break it down and put it in our garden, I think we would be much better off reducing the amount of plastic debris we see in our water bodies, in our ocean, and on our coasts. So I think that's probably that's what I see as an effective way of countering this plastic
not
pollution
creating,
problem.
Not creating more plastic, but
right.
Moving away from creating plastic. Now, you mentioned the resilience of mycelium, and I know you told me a great story about Fairbanks and a cabin, and that, where you really got the focus on the resilience. So tell us that story, because it's kind of fun.
Sure. So I started this work when I was at my prior institution at State University of New York in Brooklyn. We then decided to move to Alaska, as we have mentioned, and we loaded our Subaru up and drove from Manhattan to Fairbanks. We also, of course, I couldn't leave the cultures and the samples behind, so I brought some of the cultures with us, and then we moved into a dry cabin in Esther, Alaska, where there was not a lot of room. There was not a lot
tight
of room
space.
For everybody, yes. And so for my wife, Tasha, our son, Benjamin, and I, we have decided to put some of that lab stuff under the cabin. And I was convinced that after minus 50 degree temperatures, all of the samples would be dead by the springtime. But lo and behold, in the spring, when I dug it out of the snow underneath the cabin, I actually saw that the specimens that we have brought were thriving and growing out of the wilds, and that gave an impetus to the idea of, well, maybe we can actually use this foam-like material right here for a range of applications. That's really how that idea came.
You know, I know that in people who've lived in cold places for a long time, like I'm thinking about footwear and Alaska Native people using grasses to create insulation in footwear. And, I guess I'm just wondering whether you've ever heard of anybody else in an indigenous culture using mycelium for anything. I mean, I know you're in the scientific realm, but is there anything coming from sort of local knowledge or sort of, yeah, local knowledge about mycelium that you're aware of and its use for any insulating material or anything? Just pulling it up from the ground and, you know, packing it down and using it. Anything surface that you know about?
Well, I don't know of specific uses of mycelium in northern cultures that are similar to what we are doing, but I do know that for example the polypores that we find in the woods here they're often used for growing. I've actually seen a group of school children in Gerstelwood River community in near Delta mm-hmm. Junction, where the children actually created really nice drawings on the conchs on the polypores.
Oh, and they drew
on them. Yes, huh. Because it's a nice smooth surface to work with, and right. If you cut it, it really presents itself as a very nice kind of drawing
surface. Yeah,
surface. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So I know that I know that lichens are often used for insulation even today.
Right.
In many northern communities, you stick them between the logs, and so to create a kind of thermal break.
Right.
And lichen is, partly fungus.
Yes.
I'm sure there are other applications that I'm not aware of using fungi for many uses, including medicinal. I know, of course, chaga is a common northern fungus that many folks here in Alaska use, and across the north, it's believed to have medicinal properties.
Oh, I have not heard of that. Chaga.
Yes. Chaga, and it's commonly used in Russia and across the north as a tea.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. I'm going to throw out our numbers just one more time, because as the hour winds down, we won't be able to take calls, but right now we can. If you're interested in talking to Philippe a little bit about this growing your own insulation, give us a call at 550-8433 or maybe an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. You know, Philippe, I wanted to ask, is there anything toxic about the substances that you found out? Because I think you said to me that's one of the first questions people ask you, maybe the flammability question why do people think mushrooms might be toxic? Is it because the spores that they throw off? What do you think?
Well, I think there are some, we know that there's some toxic mushrooms that, that are poisonous. And I think that mushrooms in general in North America get bad rap because of that. But we have been asked this question over and over ever since we started. Is this material going to be toxic? So we have done some basic cytotoxicity testing where we exposed living cells to our material to see if there is any toxicity associated with the material we are using. And it was, of course, important to us also to know if this is a safe substance to work
with. The point being to have a healthier environment, right?
Correct.
Internal exactly. environment. So, yeah. And what did you find out?
We found out that there is no toxicity associated with this material. And we knew this because we know that this particular fungus is non-toxic. But we also wanted to see if there are any metabolites, any products of the breakdown of cellulose that we are feeding it that could potentially have negative health effects.
Right. You could introduce something that could potentially make it toxic. I see.
Exactly. And we found out that that's not the case. And the other interesting thing is that as we move forward with this research, we found that one of the questions that we asked, well, is this going to be allergenic? Are we going to have some air quality issues with this? So we are using vegetative part of the fungus. Mycelium is the vegetative state doesn't produce spores. It's only the mushroom, the fruiting body,
the
that produces the spores.
Okay.
Exactly. So so we are a step before that in our process in terms of the organism's of organism's lifespan. And so because we dry our blocks before they actually start producing fruiting bodies, the mushrooms, we don't have spores, so our material is spore-free.
Huh. Interesting. I've got a caller that I'm going to welcome on the line. Burl, you're here on Hometown Alaska. What's your question?
Yeah, my question was about, say, using the sheets in construction and how they would hold up to moisture in, say, foundation walls or basement walls and with direct ground contact.
That's a great question. Thank you.
Yeah.
What do you think?
We are working on it.
We
are working on it. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a good question that's been on our minds as well. What we find is that if we coat the material with water-impermeable membrane of some sort, then the material, of course, is you know is lighter than water. It doesn't absorb water because it has a it has a coating. Now, if we cut the material, which is commonly done with insulation, when in, you know in,
to fit,
exactly to fit the wall cavity, then we find that the material itself starts absorbing water rapidly, but it then also dries rapidly. So it's a different paradigm in terms of way of looking at it. And if you look at say remote walls, the question you know that this technique really begs is that you have thermal insulation on the outside, then you have a water barrier, a vapor barrier, and then you have the living space, right? So if you were to allow your water vapor to move freely through the insulation and then dry out, then it would produce different result. In other words, you would have you would still preserve the R value that's required, but you would have a different dynamic than what we have in our housing construction now. Mm. And so the building would in fact
breathe.
Which we know it doesn't do now with the way we construct our houses. So it's a different paradigm. It's early on to tell how well it will work, but we have been collaborating with Cold Climates Housing Research Center in Fairbanks, and one of our projects to work on this coming year or this year is, in fact, to test this wall application for our material to see how well it performs compared to plastic insulation and other types of insulation like rock wall.
Mm-hmm. You know, Philippe, I have a question. You said that the mycelium, when it grows, it makes its own covering, but that is not waterproof.
Well, it's water. It will repel. It will shed water. But remember that we have to cut it to fit the wall cavity. So if it's a unit that has been tooled or produced and it's not disrupted by cutting, then it will work well. It will shed water.
It's only where it's cut.
Right, but once you start slicing it, then you cut through that skin.
Okay.
And then you expose the face of the material is now becoming open for water vapor or water moisture to go through.
Mm-hmm. So, Burl, did that answer your question?
Well, yes. It sounds like it's more suited for wall application above ground rather than below ground applications where it would be continuous, moisture and is that true?
I don't yet know.
And right now
we are going to keep this open, and I think that question is really important and interesting. One thing that's fascinating about applying it live is, as Kathleen earlier said, while it's living, it has the ability to seal itself off. So when material is still alive, so to say, then if you puncture a hole through it, for example, it will self-seal. So it will it will close that hole and it will recreate that outer skin. because it's trying to protect itself. So in some applications, that may be useful. But for majority of applications, probably exposing it to heat so that it loses the moisture content and dies before application would be the way to go.
All right. Well, thank you very much. That answers my question.
Thank you, Burl. I have another email that came in that is to this. Patrick wants to know, would there be moisture in the mycelium if it was in the walls? Would that complicate the insulation process? There wouldn't be moisture if it was dead, right?
Correct.
If it was still alive. You and I had this discussion about maybe insulation under roadways might potentially be alive, right? So if there was a break in the road, the insulation would self-heal. Now, is that possible in a house?
I would say in a house, that would not be the way to do it because you do not want your house to be essentially consumed by the same fungus because the way we construct is we use
wood products.
Yeah.
And the insulation would eat your house.
That's right. The 2x4s would be very suitable feeding stock for our fungus. So it may not be the way to do it in housing construction, but for some applications, I would like to keep it in. We say I refuse to let it gel yet. I think that it's good to keep those concepts open because we are not looking just at one application. We're looking at a range of applications that can be potentially useful in creating this bio-based materials economy that we are describing and really jumpstarting innovation here in Alaska in that field and looking at it from sort of a holistic perspective of how can we address the well-being of humans as well as well-being of our environment in the systems approach. So we're looking at social and ecological systems as one and not chopping it into smaller fields of knowledge as we used to. So it's a different
approach.
Different approach,
yeah,
exactly.
Sort of keeping it holistic. You know, I didn't ask you, you know, how are you getting this work supported? I know the university has given you some support. You know, how and I also wondered whether you seek other support from the NIH or the NSF. I mean, what's the process? Are we too early on or what?
Yes. So we are grateful to University of Alaska because we've been supported initially by UA's Innovate grant. It's $25,000 grant. Now we were fortunate to get support from ConocoPhillips. It's a $50,000 grant that will allow us to really move to phase two of this process, looking at some of those questions that your listeners
asked. These great questions these listeners have.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they're very informative. I'm really grateful. I've written them down, actually.
Okay.
This is really good discussion. It informs us. We would like to collaborate and invite you to come and visit us at University of Alaska. I'm in the Department of Health Sciences, and it would be lovely to get this ideas going as we
get more people involved. Well, as you can hear from the music, Philippe, we are out of time.
Sure.
So I just have to say thank you so much for coming and sharing this project with us. And I want to thank our listeners who had such good questions. I'll be back as your host next week. We're going to do Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska, and we're going to traffic court. Well, not literally. We'll be in the studio, but we will be talking to a magistrate from traffic court. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Eric Bork is our audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.